So fixed points work, they're points for running off couplings, for example. They work, they're additional points of, basically when something stops evolving, either if it evolves, let's say for UV, for asymptotic freedom, like in the case of QCD, if it evolves to zero, then there is no, it's a non-interacting theory, the theory becomes trivial, and then you know that, I mean, you're done basically. It's a self-UV complete, it's perfectly nice, you don't need to add any new degrees of freedom to explain what's happening. Now, fixed points can work in a similar way. It tells you that the theory goes to that value of gauge couplings or Yukawa couplings or whatever. And then it means that it's a UV completion. It tells you something about the properties of the theory, that the runnings don't evolve anymore. The moment the couplings don't evolve anymore, you reach kind of like an equilibrium, let's call it, okay? Something that's not perturbed anymore, scale invariant. So I think actually there's going to be a class that by Joma that will explain all those things. So he will talk a lot about CFTs and fixed points and all that, because it's an entire topic, how it works. And you can have, as you said, IR fixed points, you can have UV fixed points for couplings. And in the standard model, it doesn't really work this way. as you did from your unification, right? The couplings don't run to the same point, for example. Anyway, so now that I have my microphone, we can start with days, and we can talk more about it afterwards. So before we start the lecture, I want to connect to what we were saying before. Where is my mouse? Okay, it's here. Let's play. Okay, it shows up there. So remember, we were talking about the predictions of unification, and you guys had the homework about sine squared theta w. I don't know, did they see that yet?
They haven't seen this yet.
Oh, God. Okay. So, okay, then I'm jumping ahead. So I told you that when you want to unify a theory, you have the two, you run the two couplings, see where they meet, and you run backwards. So the Weinberg angle in the standard model is related to the ratio of G1 and G2, right? The couplings of the SU2 and the hypercharge. So you can think about them as measuring the relative running of those two. And then you have the coupling of the strong group, SU3 or of the SU3 or alpha3, the fine structure constant of the strong interactions. So you can actually parameterize the predictions of unification in this 2D plane, the Weinberg angle and the coupling of the strong interactions. You can pick some other axes, but this is what people picked. And there is a prediction for the non-supersymmetric guts, the ground unified theories of Howard and George Ivett. Why does it do that? It just did that, right? Okay. Oh, God. Yeah, okay. But it's half and half.
It's periodic.
It's topological. That's a non-trivial. Oh, this is great. Okay. Okay, sorry. Let me mirror displays and see how that works. No, it's an issue. Oh, it's the... Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. So when people in the early days, when they measured 1981, when they measured sine squared theta w and alpha 3, this was a measurement, and it was agreeing with a higher George I standard model unification. People were super happy, great. And as time passed, LEP came, the electron-positron collider at CERN, and you saw the error bars shrunk, and they actually agreed with supersymmetry. And we'll talk about supersymmetry next week. So this is actually a measurement that gave a boost to supersymmetric unification, okay? And this is part of your homework, and again, we get, okay? And then this is where we are kind of today. It agrees very well. It's very far away from the standard model unification prediction, and it's there. So you can actually turn, as I was saying before, a unification can be a predictive framework. You can have some predictions, you can try test them with experiments, which is really cool. Okay, so the question is, what do you actually unify to? And for that, now I need to turn everything off. stop. Just that worked. And okay, so I mentioned last time, Georgia and Glashow from 1974, that said, okay, I can embed the SU3 color, the SU2 weak, or left, as we call it, a UN hypercharge. This is all contained SU5. Okay. This was so this goes back. This is again an aesthetics process. So we want to unify the gauge groups and make them as smaller group as possible. Now, just the realization that they did is simple. Have you guys done Lie groups in your okay? Then you would know that SU5 has n squared minus 1, which is 24 generators. It means it has 24 gauge bosons. And when you write them down in matrix form, okay, so there are 5 by 5 matrices. The SU3 sits up here. The SU2 sits here. And the off-diagonal elements are what are known as X and Y bosons, okay? So you have the octet of the color. This is color. You have the 1, 3. These are the generators of SU2. Let's call it the W and the Z boson. Then you have the generator of hypercharge. I'll talk about this a bit more. And then there is this funny gauge bosons that have kind of like both formally they have, because they are off diagonal, the mix kind of, if you have something that couples with color and something that couples with SU2, which are the weak interactions, it kind of mixes. They are off diagonal, so it mixes the two. So it has both a baryon and lepton number. So they have these this charge assignment, so this is the X, and we will talk later about what they do. So they have these funny hypercharges, okay? So these are the X and Y bosons that carry both actually baryon and lepton number, because you will see that when you write down the representations of the matter fields, they can mix quark to leptons. So, okay, so these are the generators. The nice thing about the SU5 is that it the matter fields nicely fit, the standard modern matter fields easily fit in fundamental and antisymmetric presentations of the gauge group. So if you have an antifundamental of SU5, a 5 bar, it contains 3 bar, 1/3, which is the D-type quark. And it has this minus a half, which is the left-hand lepton. Yes?
I'm sorry, I'm a bit confused about the notation.
Yes.
So that matrix is the way we embed SU2 cross SU3 cross SU2 cross hypercharge into SU5.
Sorry, that again.
It's that matrix is the way we take the standard model gauge group and we fit it into SU.
Yes, yes.
And what were the X's and Y's?
So these are the off-diagonal elements that don't fit really. I mean, they are kind of mixing. They are additional gauge bosons, right? Because you have, if you come, you have 24 total gauge bosons. But if you come in the standard model, you have 8 plus 3, 11, plus 1, 12. Okay? So you have extra 12 degrees of freedom And those extra 12 degrees of freedom are these new extra gauge bosons that are there because you have a higher symmetry group. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, yes?
But these only count to 10 x and y.
Say that again?
X and y count only to 10 extra degrees of freedom.
No, they count to, it's 3 times 2, it's 6 and 6. You multiply 3 and 2. You don't add.
That is the U1 charge.
This is the U1 charge. So when I write, this is the color. This is SU2. This is U1. So the U1 you don't add, but you multiply. So it's 3 times 2, 6. Okay? So it's 6 times 6, 12. 6 plus 6, sorry. 6 times 6 is 36. okay. So, and I will come back a bit to the representations, okay? So the 5 bar, the anti-fundamental of SU5, contains the right-handed, what we call right-handed down-type quarks, and the left-handed leptons. So this is where the neutrinos are. And you also have an antisymmetric representation. It's a 10. It has basically, what, as the name suggests, 10 elements. And here you have the quarks, and you have the 3 bars of the up-type quark. And you also have the right-handed electrons, okay? So this is U. And then you have to remind yourself that all of these have a family index, right? And then we have E right, and then I goes from 1 and 3. So you'd see that each family of quarks fits nicely into a 5 bar and antisymmetric representation of SU5. Okay? Good. Now I'm leaving one particle out from the standard model. Which one is that? What am I leaving out?
The neutrino.
Well, the right-hand neutrino is not yet in the standard model. So low energies, think low energies. What else? What am I missing here?
A Higgs.
Yeah, there you go. So the question is, so the Higgs is a doublet of SU2. The simplest thing I can do to embed this, you see here that the Higgs has the opposite charge as this guy. So the simplest thing I can do is to, instead of doing an anti-fundamental, I do a fundamental of SU5. Okay? So that means I have the Higgs. Then I have also a colored Higgs, what is called the triplet Higgs. Okay? So I need to make the degrees, so I need to add additional degrees of freedom to embed the standard model Higgs into the SU5. So for the families, it works really nicely. But for the Higgs, I get extra stuff. And I also get extra stuff for the gauge bosons. Okay? Now, there is something that I glossed a bit over. So in these generators here, you have the SU3 here, the SU2 sits here, and then the off-diagonal are the extra gauge bosons. There is one generator for the U1 hypercharge, which is embedded like this. So you have 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, minus a half, minus a half, and then it's multiplied. So this is the generator associated with hypercharge, okay? And this is important for two reasons. Now, in ordinary theories, if I just have a U1, the charge is not fixed. It's not quantized, meaning I can have a charge 1. But my theory makes equal sense if I add a charge of 0.1 or even 10 to the minus 20. So if I just have a U1 symmetry, charge quantization is not guaranteed. The theorem makes perfect sense. That don't have to have integer charges. Okay? So as long as I have a particle and an antiparticle to cancel anomalies and whatnot, but charge quantization is not guaranteed. So one of the nice things about the GATS, the embedding of the standard model group in a higher representation, is that it automatically explains charge quantization. Do you have a question? Because I see you puzzled.
Yeah, because we usually think of the U1 representations as being completely described by the integers.
No, no. So when you write the kinetic term, right, for a U1, what you have is, let's say for a fermion, you have psi dagger, you have d nu slash, and then you have ig, and let's say I'm going to write gq, a mu, and then you have, d mu here, and then you have sigma mu bar psi. So you see here what is relevant for the interactions, it's g times q. So there's no, the representations of the Lie group has a very specific structure where everything's an integer, whatever non-integer part you absorb in the coupling. Here, wow, that's my structure. I can have Q can be anything a priori. Yeah. So this was a nice thing about GATS. In fact, and a very interesting cute experimental fact, we know that the charge of the proton to the electron are equal in better than 1 part in 10 to the 20. So people have been looking, testing this. This is a fundamental principle of the standard model. So people have been testing for a long time. Okay. So, great. So far we have embedded the, I should also say, even though I'm not sure, have you guys done anomalies yet? Did you discuss anomalies? Very little. You will discuss it more also with Junwoo.
You saw how we get all the hypercharges.
Oh, that's great. So the cool thing about the SU5 is that when you calculate the anomalies associated with this 5 bar and a 10, they are perfectly anomaly free. So the minimum thing you can do to embed the fermions of the standard model into representation turns out to be non-problematic as well. So you don't need to add any extra particles to make the theory self-consistent, okay? Which is really cool. So, but we know, so I need to write here, charge quantization explained in GATS. Okay. So this is all beautiful and nice, but we know the low energy theory is not SU5. So we need to break it. And the minimum way to break it is to give a VEV to an adjoint of SU5. An adjoint is something that has 24 elements, right? And so basically, it's giving a VEV to something that commutes with this generator, so you don't break a hypercharge. So it's something that has a VEV times third minus a half. So SU3 commutes with this. SU2 commutes with this. The hypercharge generator commutes with this. But the X and Y bosons do not. So from this VEV, the X and Y bosons will get a mass. Okay? And the mass of the SU5 bosons will be G5 times this VEV of, let's call it, of this adjoint. So now, okay, we've broken RSU5. So now, what are the consequences of this, and what is the phenomenology further? Okay. Gut scale. So in order to get the full structure of the standard model, so we've done the first thing, break the symmetry. What is the other thing we need to do at low energies? We need to write the Yukawa couplings, okay? So in order to write to the Yukawa couplings, we need to write couplings between these things. The, yes?
Your triple is, should it have a minus name?
No. Yes, you're right, sorry, yes.
No, it has to be different from the D.
Yes, you're right, sorry, you're absolutely right. I made a mistake, yes, this is minus a third, yeah. Thank you for catching it. Yes, sorry. Good. So we need to write the Yukawa couplings. So the way, there are two types of Yukawa couplings you can write. I'm not gonna spend a lot of time explaining how. So you can write this. Turns out you can contract as a gauge singlet. So you can write, this is the Higgs and these are the matter fields. And this is something that contains the uptype Yukawa coupling. So it has Higgs coupled to Q and U. But it also has additional couplings because the Higgs now has a bigger representation. We have extra particles. So this color Higgs, I will call it H. And this guy will call HC, the colored Higgs. So it has C, QQ, plus UE. Okay. There is also, we need to write the down type Yukawas as well. So this you do by, the 5 here is a scalar particle, so there is a dagger here. And then 10, the 5 bar. And then this contains now the H dagger, QD. So these are the down type Yukawas. You have the fermion Yukawas here, the lepton Yukawas here. But again, you have things you have these additional couplings because you have the colored Higgses, okay? This is actually where things start getting a bit interesting, okay? So notice here that the colored Higgses have couplings to both quarks, have terms that mix both quarks and leptons. So they mediate baryon number violation. So you see here, there's this coupling right here. So if you were to write it down as diagrammatically, so you have Q, Q, have HC, have HC dagger here, and then you would have the other side, Q, L. You have this operator. What is the dimensionality? What is the dimensionality of this operator? Have you discussed dimensions of fundamental fields in your classes?
Yes.
Okay.
They are fermions.
Okay, they are fermions. So, what is the dimensionality of this operator in 4 dimensions? Okay, I mean. 3 plus 1 dimensions. Good. So that means that what do I need to put it to make it compatible with writing it in a Lagrangian? What do I need to divide by? Say it louder.
M squared.
Yes. And what specifically M squared? Of what? It's there in the diagram.
The Higgs mass?
Yes. So this is a dimension 6 proton decay operator. Okay? And of course, I'm leaving out, this is Yukawa's here, right? So there is J, K, L, because here I have different families. So basically, this converts baryons to leptons. So if I were to take, now I can do the following. I can take this diagram. So imagine that this is the up-type quark, okay? So a proton, you know, decomposes to U, right? U and D. Right? So I can take this to be a U, this to be a U, so I have this diagram right here. You have the colored Higgs here. And then now I have, I'm going to flip the lepton. So I have a lepton here. And then I have, call it a U bar, or I can call it a D bar. And I have the line going here, D. So now, what is this? You guys did standard model. What type of particle is this? If I consider the fact that QCD confines and
meson.
Yes, and what type of meson? Like for the D, for the first family. No. If it's the first family, what is it? Pion. Yeah. So if it involves only the quarks of the first family, it's a pion, okay? So this is pi zero. And this, to preserve charge, this lepton here has to be a positron. So this is a process that takes the proton, 2e plus, and pi zero. You can have also gone to neutrino and a charged pion. So this is the process of proton decay. Okay? Now, can someone tell me what is the rate of the decay? So,
proton is not expected to decay.
Well, let's discuss this. For the time being, we don't know. We are just discussing what the theory wants to do, right? So what is the rate of decay? I'm asking a theoretical. Can you tell me how, does anyone know how to estimate a decay rate? So how would you estimate? What is the lifetime? Have you done two-body decays? Okay, so this is a two-body decay, right? So how does it scale like?
It's a volume integral of mod of amplitude.
Yeah. It's a volume integral of everything, moment, blah, 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 blah. Basically, it's a matrix element squared times some phase space, right? So tell me first, what do you expect the matrix integral to be, the matrix element to be? It's right there in the Feynman diagram and the Lagrangian thing.
It should depend on the two couplings.
Yes, and what else? So it's basically Yukawa, yes, there's Yukawa, let's call it. So is it, how many powers of the couplings? Sorry?
Well, one for each.
Vertex, yes. But then that's the is that the amplitude or the amplitude squared?
So it needs to be four.
It needs to be four, right? So it goes like some couplings to the fourth. So four powers of the coupling. Okay, maybe different couplings, but overall four powers of the coupling. What else?
Higgs propagator.
Mm-hmm. So? And it is what?
One over,
it's right there.
1 over p squared minus.
Yeah, but this is very heavy, right? So p is zero. So.
1 over p squared.
Yeah, but what power?
Half.
Okay. m Higgs to the fourth, does it have the right units to be a decay rate? So a decay rate is a lifetime, right? So it's an inverse right lifetime. So it's units of inverse time. So units of inverse times in natural units, what power, what is it in terms of energy? How many powers of energy? Eh?
Is it one?
Yes. So how many powers is this? This is mass, right? This is mass. Let me put this up. So this, how many powers? Don't cheat. You see? No. We have time. Okay. So this is how many powers of what power of the energy is this quantity? Exactly. So what do you need to add to make it one power of energy plus one power?
Five.
Exactly. So what five? What is the what energy to the fifth do you put? What is the available energy in the decay of the proton? Let's say these are guys are massless. Exactly. Okay. Good. And there is just as a, because clearly you haven't done this before, you should know that every time I have one guy going to two, there is an additional 1/4 pi that you get because you remember there is the volume integrals of the momentum and all that. So that gives you just as a rule of when you want to do order of magnitude estimates, there is 1/4 pi. And every time you add a particle in the decay, and you let's consider all the particles massless. So if you go to from one, you go to three, you need to add an additional loop factor, 4 pi times 16 pi squared. So that roughly gives you the right phase space factors, just to give you a way to do quick estimates of lifetimes and processes. Okay, so now we have our proton lifetime and we'll calculate it now. Okay, let's do, given that we started this game. So if I were to ask you to calculate an interaction cross-section from this diagram and assume particles are massless, okay, just to make our lives easier, and I'm working at energies below the mass of the color Higgs's. So how would the cross-section scale like?
It should be something like the coupling that we're considering.
So, yes. Yeah, let's say, again, the same principle applies. It's the matrix elements times some phase space factors, okay? And we can discuss what the phase space factors are. So again, what do you expect for the matrix element squared? It's the same diagram. I haven't changed it's exactly the same diagram. I'm just telling you to calculate a different quantity from it. I don't want, look, I don't care about factors of 2, I don't even care about factors of 10, I just want scaling with energy and the parameters of the problem and the couplings. So rough scalings, right? So which is useful if you want to calculate any sort of process or you're solving a problem in my research, what I do these type of things all the time because I need to have a ballpark estimate of a rate of a process I care about. So this is actually a useful skill to have. I know I'm putting you guys in the spot, but I mean, it's simple rules once you get the hang of it. But so again, it's matrix element squared and some phase space. Okay, so the matrix element squared, what is it? I mean, it's the same diagram, okay? And I'm telling you I work at energies below the mass of the colored Higgs. And everything else is massive. Forget about mass of quarks and electrons or anything.
It's the same diagram.
Exactly.
So you power off to the four.
Exactly. Well, the colored Higgs is not a
massive. Okay, so then that to the four as well.
Exactly. That's it. That's the matrix element. Now phase space. Okay? Phase space basically kind of recovers available energy and also dimensions. So we're talking about cross-section. Cross-section has units of area. So in natural units, area is what? Energy to what power? Exactly. Energy to the minus 2. So what do I need to multiply to make it energy to the minus 2? Sorry, I'm taking everything is massless, right? So I just have some doing things at some energy. So what is the energy scale that I've got? Yeah, exactly. No, wait. Cubed. Wait. Yes. Or energy or momentum, which means everything is mass. Also. There, it turns out there is an additional 4 pi from the usual normalization factors of the momentum volume. Okay, so you see the scale is slightly different, or they're different quantities, but that's basically the key. So you write your matrix element based on the what you write down and the energies that you work at. And then you multiply with appropriate phase space factors to recover the units and whatever factors of pi with the rough guides that I gave you. Okay? Good. Okay. Fantastic. So let's put this up and let's do some math. Okay? Even more math now. So let's try to estimate the lifetime of the Higgs. Okay, let's plug some numbers. So let's assume for simplicity that I put myself in a pickle now because Yukawas are small. But let's put Yukawas 10 minus 5 for the electrons, put everything 10 minus 5, okay? So 10 minus 5 is 10 minus 20. 10 minus 5 to the fourth, 10 minus 20, okay? Yukawa is right, 10 minus 5. Now, there is a 4 pi. Between friends, 4 pi is 10, okay? We're doing order of magnitude estimates, right? Now, so we have the mass of the Higgs, which is 1 GeV, roughly, fifth. Okay? So the question is, what do I put for the mass of the colored Higgs? The naive thing. What should I put?
Order of the mass of the Higgs.
Exactly. So because they are in the same multiplet, naively you would say they have to be the same mass. Okay? So I put here 100 GeV to the fourth. Okay? So this becomes 10 to minus 21. This is 10 to the 4. And 10 to the minus 8 GeV. Now this is 10 to the minus 29 GeV. And I will give you this conversion. So 1 second inverse is roughly 10 to the minus 24 GeV. Okay? So that means if I want to convert this to seconds, I need to multiply with 10 to the 24, right? Fast or slow? Very fast. We wouldn't be here if it was that fast. So this is actually a very big problem for GATS. It tells you that you cannot have the triplet Higgses at the same mass as the Higgs. So this is what is known as the double-triplet splitting problem. And it creates problems with the way you break the symmetry. So for example, I gave you the, before up there I told you, oh, you write that sigma vev, which is very simple. It tells you you have to create much more complicated structures to give mass to the triplet part of the Higgs and not give mass to the doublet part of the Higgs. Okay? Yes?
How did you start with the decay rate and the Boyzmann
lifetime? Oh, sorry. You're right. This is inverse seconds. Okay. Sorry. You're right. This would be inverse seconds. Thank you. So this is like the lifetime is 10 to the 5 seconds. Still pretty fast. This is less than an hour, by the way. This is 3 hours, roughly. So an hour is 3,600 seconds. Yes?
So my understanding is that the reason why the proton decay happens is because of that Feynman diagram we drew up there?
Yeah.
Where the colored Higgs somehow couples quarks with the leptons?
Yes.
Instead of trying to think of a different way of breaking the SU5 symmetry, is there a way to make that interaction
small? No, because you need to write the Yukawas, right? So if you look at the Yukawas there, so if you make the Higgs, look at that coupling right there. So it's the same Yukawa that multiplies both the, let me lower this. That's a good question. I mean, there are people have played games, and we can discuss what people have done, what monstrosities people have done to fix this problem. But the point is that the simplest thing you can do doesn't work, because this Yukawa, if I have a coupling here, IJ, it's the same IJ that multiplies this term. It's the same that multiplies this term and this term. So if I fix the masses of the quarks at low energies, because I've measured the Yukawas at low energies, it also fixes these couplings. Especially for the lightest families, they don't run, right? So the couplings are very small, so they don't really evolve from here to the GATS scale. So whatever, I mean, a 10 to the minus 5 coupling will stay 10 to the minus 5. So this is a problem. You really have to make these guys heavy to make just get rid of them from the spectrum. Now, just to give you an idea, so in fact, the lifetime of the Higgs, the lifetime of the proton, we found it to be has to be larger than 10 to the 35 years. So people have done huge experiments. They've taken tanks of pure water, and they look for tons of protons decaying. Okay, so they found that the 10 to the 35. What is the age of the universe?
16b.
10 to the 10 years. So this is like 10 to the 25 orders of magnitude longer than the age of the universe. Okay. The interesting thing is, though, that this kind of matches the prediction. So the triplet Higgses are a problem, and let's assume you solve that problem for a second. There is another thing that can mediate proton decay, and that is the X and Y bosons, right? Because in their interactions, they are off diagonal elements. They sit over here. So for example, if they can take when you write the interactions of the five, they can make these guys interact. So the X and Y bosons also mediate proton decay. And for these guys, the lifetime is slightly different. So it goes like the Gates coupling to the fourth power, because these are the gauge bosons. There's a 4 pi, as always. The proton mass to the 5th power, and then you have the mass of the X and Y bosons, the 4th. So these guys now, so if you plug in this number right here, the 10 to the 35, you find that M is roughly 10 to the 16 GeV. So when you guys do your homework, you will see, remember last time we were drawing diagrams where you had the 3 couplings of the standard model, you will see that for SUSY, for supersymmetric theories, this is T, this was X, and this is T, and this was 1, 2, and 3. You would find that actually, in fact, for supersymmetric theories, they unify at 10 to the 16 GeV roughly, which was really nice. So right now, the current bound is compatible with supersymmetric unification. But the question is, how easy is it to probe it? So the question is, how did we manage to measure, to constrain such a small number? What do you do?
We don't have any protons in our big thing, and then we multiply by how long we did.
Exactly. So the rate of decay is basically tau times the number of the protons you have. So when you calculate, there is this great experiment in Japan called Super Kamiokande, where the best constraint comes from, and that has like this n is like 10 to the 34. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of, tens of thousands of tons of very pure water.
It's heavy water too.
Yeah. So you compensate this very long time scale with a huge number, ultra low backgrounds. A really cool experiment. Now the question is, for a given, so now we know how the lifetime scales. So now if I wanted to improve the bound on the scale of the X and Y boson mass by a factor of 10, how much bigger do I need to make my detector?
So is the volume? What do you mean by bigger?
What factor N has to be bigger by? Like, how much bigger is the volume of the detector given the same amount of material? If I want to make this bound 10 times better.
10 times?
No, it's less than 4. It would need to be, it would be 1,000 times bigger?
10 to the 4 times bigger, right? If I wanted a factor of 10 here, I need to make it 10 to the 4 times bigger. Right? So these experiments very quickly hit like some sort of ceiling. Because, I mean, there is a limit to how much bigger you can make the detector. And in fact, there is an approval of Super Kamiokande, where this bound comes from, is getting upgraded to Hyper Kamiokande. And there you will get, I mean, it's going to be a much bigger thing, 200 meters. I mean, we're talking about but nevertheless, you get only a factor of a few reach in this number. So at some point, these experiments become really hard. Okay? Still extremely important. I should say, though, that remember the plot that I showed you in the beginning, the 80s, that the sine squared theta was measured in this. So if you would do the same trick with unification in the standard model, so where they don't really unify, let's say ballpark unification, this scale is 10 to the 14 GeV. So if the unification scale is 10 to the 14, this means that this number is 8 orders of magnitude faster. So it's smaller. So it's like 10 to the 27 or something. Okay? So that means back in the day, in the 80s, there was an experiment with much smaller volume that was looking for proton decay, and they had a few events. So people in the early 80s for a while, for a few years, thought that they had discovered Suzy Gatz, and they were super excited, but, well, the rest is history, of course. We talked about proton decay. That's very nice things. Now, there are other indirect observables, okay, that you can have. So there is the proton decay, which is the prediction of GATS. For example, if you didn't have a GAT, and let's say the only proton decay you could mediate was the Planck scale. The Planck scale is 10 to the 19 GeV. So if you were to plug 10 to the 19 GeV, you would find that this is 12 orders of magnitude longer. Okay? So you would go to 10 to the whatever, 47 years. So it's impossible to probe. So this is the fact that you have a prediction. Let me take this all the way up. Okay. Good. Now, so other indirect observables have to do with the Yukawas. Where did I write them? So do you see up there? So if you look at the second line of Yukawa couplings, so you have the 5 dagger coupling the 10 and a 5 bar, you see that it's the same coupling for the down type quarks and the leptons. Okay? So it means that at the GATS scale, I need to unify. It means that the down type quarks and the leptons are degenerate. So there is a prediction that at the GATS scale, the bottom mass, the bottom quark mass has to be the same as the tau mass. And in fact, if you look at low energies, the bottom mass is, let me remember the number, just to mess it up. Yeah, this is 4. At the Z mass, at low energies, is 4.2 GeV, M tau is 1.7 GeV. So if you take a G running into account, you see that they can unify. So people were excited about what is called flavor structure of the standard model. So it kind of fitted very well. And people started building models that try to unify all the flavors on the quarks and the leptons in the same find underlying structures of the Yukawas. Okay? The problem with that program, I mean, this is very nice, the prediction of the bottom, they call it bottom tau unification. Everything, the beauty of this is spoiled by the other two generations. And there it doesn't work that well. And people started doing acrobatics with huge representations again. And things got very ugly. Okay? But this is a game people played for quite some time, especially in the 80s and early 90s. This was very fashionable to do, to play. But a problem with the quark masses, and you will have next in 2 weeks' time, you'll actually have a lecture about the flavor structure of the standard model and what people have tried, and also how it probes new physics and all that. So anyway, flavor is not, let's say, the most beautiful part of the standard model. Good. So for the last few minutes, because we started a bit late, I reviewed SU5 unification, and this was the simplest group. But people, of course, have imagined even bigger groups or other types of structures that you can embed the standard model. Another simple extension, and in fact, it was kind of discovered before SU5, is SO10 unification. And this contains SU5, but it also contains an additional U1, which is nothing else than B minus L. Okay? So you know, probably, I don't know if you discussed in your standard model class that B minus L is not gauged in the standard model. There's no U1 B minus L gauge boson, but it is anomaly free in principle. So it could be a gauged U1. You can gauge it. And turns out in SL10, this is embedded naturally. So the way you would embed, so the matter fields in SL10 are embedded in a 16 representation, which contains a 10, has a 5 bar, and it also has a 1. So you see that the families now in SL10, each family fits in a single representation, which is really nice. And you get this extra little guy who is the right-handed neutrino. So in SO10, this is one family, and this is right-handed neutrinos. So the right-handed neutrinos are very natural to have in SO10 unification. And in combination with B-L, you can actually write Dirac masses for the neutrinos. So there is a nice framework where everything just fits kind of nicely together, okay? And you can write the corresponding Yukawas. So the Yukawa here, so the Higgs is in a 10, and the Higgs has a 5 and a 5 bar. So now we have the problem with the triplet Higgs, but now we have even more Higgs. So in fact, here, there is the Higgs is actually, the Higgs has become a Higgs doublet model. So you have two Higgs doublet model. And it fits very well in supersymmetric theories, actually, this feature. But whatever problems you had before with the triplet Higgs, you had again, and it's now, if you want to give, people were given, just to give you an idea, in order to break SO10, people were given VEVs to 126 representations of SO10. So it starts getting silly at some point to get the vacuum structure right. If you ask our advisor, Marie, he'll tell you he had some kind of nice ideas of how to get this done back then. Anyway, and this is where I'll stop, okay? So people for a while were studying this, and it did give a nice hint, as I told you. The data seems to suggest that some form of unification is there. The problem, though, as you saw with proton decay, it becomes harder and harder to probe. You cannot build, it's very hard. You build a bigger detector, but you don't gain a lot in your mass reach, in the scale of unification that you can do. It's still, though, a kind of underlying prediction, especially this nice feature of unification that you will see in supersymmetric theories, and you guys will play around, and that's it. Okay? Yes?
Dendi was varying the mass of the Higgs triplet in order to get different cross-sections.
Yeah.
Why are you not varying the Yukawa coupling, because they run with energy scales?
Yeah, as I told you, so because the Yukawa couplings, when you write them down, so when you write down the Yukawa couplings like this, where you unify the triplet and the doublet Higgs, you correlate the couplings of the ordinary Higgs to the couplings of the colored Higgs. They are the same. Okay, so you cannot really change, for example, the coupling to the electron. Like, you cannot change this coupling without changing this coupling as well. So which means you're changing the up and down mass couplings. So you mess up your theory quite a bit. And couplings don't run. Like Yukawas, I mean, I told you about the bottom tau unification, but those are some of the largest Yukawas you have, and it's a tiny change. For the electron Yukawa, the electron Yukawa is 10^-5. It doesn't really run. I mean, take a loop. I mean, if you do, it goes like dy, d mu goes like y to the cubed power. So it's a tiny change with for a logarithmic running. So you cannot, unfortunately, you cannot play that game. So you really need to get rid of them from the spectrum. I mean, yeah. And I put in the estimate, remember, the one that we saw that the proton decays in a few hours, I put the up-down Yukawa, I put 10^-5, it was already a small suppression was there. I didn't put the order 1 Yukawa for the top. If I had done that, whoo-hoo, proton would have gone Okay, more questions? One.
Is there any way to see how to get Lagrangian terms directly from group representations, because you wrote 5, 10, 10, and 5 dagger, 10, 5, 5?
Yeah, so that you will play around, you can play around. I didn't want to spend time. Usually,
things like how to figure out that.
I don't want, then I'm going to be solving the homework for you, so I don't want. You'll be playing around. I mean, yeah, but you'll play, yeah. So, but you do it in a similar way that you would do the Higgs. So 10 is an anti-symmetric representation. You will give them that, right? The 10. Okay, that part you will give them. So a 10 is an anti-symmetric representation. What does it mean? It means that when I write the 10 here, I decompose it this way. It's in fact is a 5x5 matrix. Because it's an anti-symmetric, it means you have zeros on the diagonal. You will see that the U-type quarks fit here, Q fits here, and E fits here. With some appropriate, and then you have the opposite, with the opposite signs on this here. So, and then you write appropriately the representation of 5 bar, you write in a column usually, where you put the D here and the L here. So now it becomes a matrix appropriate matrix multiplication game where you try to preserve the appropriate symmetries and all that, and you will play around. Does that make sense? Okay. So next time, so far I've talked about aesthetic problems because the unification was not essential. I could have left the standard model as is. There was nothing wrong with it. You needed some UV completion somewhere. But in principle, I could have left it as is. So in a way, unification is an aesthetics problem. It's not a it doesn't solve any real issue. It just makes the standard model slightly prettier, okay? So on Monday, I will talk about hierarchy problems. And those are actually much more essential. I'll try to convey that to you. They're not just aesthetics, okay? So thank you, guys, and for your questions.